Welcome to Mom Talk Radio, the show that tackles topics important to you and your family, finances, food, education, technology, and everything in between. We've got it covered on Mom Talk. And now, here's Mary Donnellan on Mom Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mom Talk Radio. This is Mary Donnellan in for Maria Bailey, and it is the middle of August, well, almost the end. And if your community and home is like mine, you are heading back to school. Your kids are heading back to school. And for some parents, it's bittersweet. Most parents I know are thinking it's more sweet than bitter, and they're kind of cheering as the school bus pulls up to the end of the block and the kids get back to school. And more importantly, it's about the routine. For me personally, it's almost a lot more. It is a lot more work during the summer, just getting them to and from camps that don't run all day, and you know, the 8 to 12 p.m. camp, which just drives me crazy. So it settles down a little bit, and of course, I think back to school signals the beginning of fall, and then sure enough, before you know it, it's going to be Halloween, Thanksgiving, and then of course, Christmas and Hanukkah. So happy back to school season. I will mention that. Maria has just gotten back from a National College Move-In Week road trip. She visited a series of at-home stores. Go to athome.com for information. These are home decor superstores that offer everything for mostly, well, for any home and apartment and small space. But typically, when you're moving a child, son or daughter, into a college space, an apartment or a dorm, At Home has really awesome options. Not only the functional, which is what moms obviously focus on, like the underbed storage boxes and baskets that you can line up in a closet, but and shoe racks and those kind of things, and bedding. But it also has fun things, and these are what the college students love. We just did a survey of moms across the country and found some really interesting information. And the kids, students loved, first on their list actually of shopping for their dorm or apartment in college, was string lights and wall hangings and fun inspirational pillows. Really, really cute stuff. And At Home has all of it. So take a look next time you have a chance, athome.com. Find a store near you. Prices are really, really great. Maria had done us a shop for her daughter, Madison, who started at Notre Dame last week for her master's program. She got a really cute room set up, cute decor for under $100. It was a really great deal. So, and when we come back, we've got a great show lined up. We're going to be talking to Jessica Alexander, who is a co-author of the book, The Danish Way of Parenting. That's going to compare countries and our parenting styles. Cindy Simmons of the Spotlight on Moms. She is actually a breast cancer survivor, and her blog is called Surviving Mommy, and she's got a great story to tell. And then we're going to have fun with Faith Sally. She's an experienced media personality. She contributes to the CBS News Sunday Morning Show. And my favorite, she is a contributor to NPR's Wait, Don't Tell Me. That's one of my favorite, actually, one of my favorite radio shows. And then she actually wrote a book called Approval Junkie, and it's humorous essays she's written that talk about her constant need for approval through her whole life. And I think many, many, many of us can relate. So we will be jumping into the show really quickly. I want to mention, too, our sponsor, Premama. It's drinkpremama.com is the website. You'll find out all the information about all the fantastic prenatal vitamins and fertility and lactation supplements you can put in your drink. Drinkpremama.com. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Jessica Alexander. Stay with us.
Mom's Little Secret. Mom Talk Radio.
Our first guest on this edition of Mom Talk Radio is Jessica Alexander. She is the co-author of The Danish Way of Parenting. She is actually an American expat who married a Dane and is living in Rome with her husband and two children. Welcome to Mom Talk Radio, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me.
So as I said before the segment, we obviously have so much influence from how we were brought up, but you're talking about cultural influences more than, you know, are where we live, or what is the Danish way of parenting philosophy?
Well, you know, I think we often think about what it means to be a parent, but we rarely think about what it means to be an American parent, or, you know, whatever culture we come from, and how that culture affects the way we see things. And I'm married to a Dane, and I have been for 15 years, and I was really, really struck by the children there and how well-behaved they are and how happy they are. And And so when I had my own children, I found myself preferring all the Danish advice and philosophy to any of the books I had read or the way I was raised. And then later on, I discovered that Denmark has been voted as the happiest people in the world for 40 years in a row. This year, again, they're number one. And that's when I kind of, the light bulb in my head went off, and I realized that there's a Danish way of parenting, and it must be the reason why they're so happy. So,
what's that Danish way of parenting then versus, is it a comparison between, so you can compare Americans versus Danish parents?
Yeah, because it really affected me as an American, and helped me so much that I really wrote it for Americans. It has since been taken by a lot of countries who are interested, but it was mainly for Americans. And some of the main differences are they have a huge focus on play in Denmark. It's seen as an educational thing for children since 1871. And while we're talking about it a lot in America now, I think because we can't measure it, we haven't like fully embraced it yet. But by looking to this country where it is a priority for parents to have their kids be involved in free play, it's they're coming out to be the happiest people in the world. I think that's really interesting proof that it works. They also actively teach empathy in schools. So it's as important as teaching math or English, which is a huge difference.
What do you mean by so obviously you're right, it's not measurable, but how do you teach empathy?
Right.
In other words, just an example of how you would see that in a classroom.
In preschool, they have a national program in place where they show kids pictures of other kids' emotions, and they have them talk about it and describe it and, you know, practice putting themselves in other kids' shoes, and this is already in preschool. So there's a lot of different examples like that. But what's interesting is that we know that empathy is important, and I think here we kind of assume that we just had it. But what we're finding is that actually you have to teach empathy, and you get better at it. And what's been interesting for me writing this book was you can do it as an adult as well and get better at empathy. And this is something your children mirror. And empathy is a huge factor in improved well-being. And Denmark's a hugely empathic culture because of that.
Right. No, I agree. It's something, you're right, you almost assume that somebody's, you know, going to learn, going to know how to be empathetic, but that's not true. You do need to teach it to kids.
Mm-hmm. In last thing, they have something called hygge, which is a very Danish concept, which means cozy times with friends and family. And I've been doing it for years, but I finally figured out why it works so well in Denmark. It's because there are these rules that basically what it is a sacred psychological space you enter in with your loved ones. So the way we describe it is imagine you enter this psychological space, and at the door you leave your stress, your work problems, your complaining, negativity, bragging, anything that will put any other people on guard. So it's a way of like choosing certain times where you can be together in a drama-free space.
I like
that.
And
it's awesome. It's amazing. And it so works. The thing is that Danes do it because they grew up doing it. But it only takes a little bit of awareness of us. And in this chapter, we talk a lot about you can take a hygge oath, for example. And I've done this with my family. And basically, you know what mindfulness is?
Oh, yes, sure.
Right, okay. So the way we talk about it is like wefulness. And since it's for a period of time, a limited period of time, it makes it so much easier to focus on we time rather than me time. Just for that, you know, it could be a lunch, it could be a dinner. And in that time, you can play games, you can joke around, you can tell good memories, anything that makes people feel psychologically safe together. And it's the kids who benefit the most from this because they love this drama-free time with their families.
Right.
So the hope is that it gets passed on as a legacy, right? Because this is a huge factor in why they're so happy, because this value fosters social connectedness with people you love.
Oh,
and there's all kinds of other times to complain about your work stress and, you know, Aunt Jenny and everything else, right? But by creating hygge space, you have these moments where, you know, you can connect.
For me,
lovely.
It would be, you know, the teens in my life, they need the drama-free zone. They need to leave their drama out too.
Yes.
right?
Yes, it's really recharging. It's
interesting.
It's something so simple, but it works.
Yeah. So when you talk about then the classroom in schools, let's say, so they teach empathy almost as a course, just like you said, science and math. What else is it? Because I feel like in the classroom in the States, we just have so test driven. Is that the same?
Yeah, no. And that's what I'm really hoping as this book catches on and spreads. I'm really hoping that we start reevaluating also what an education is. You know,
right.
And that there's also more to education than just academics. I think we're kind of losing sight of that. And that's also why, for example, incorporating free play, you know, it seems something so basic, but we know that it is teaching also empathy and negotiation
right.
skills mm-hmm. and coping mechanisms. Kids are learning how to test their own limits with fear, which makes them better coping with anxiety. So, there's a lot of things actually we can do. Even though it's not in the school system, as parents, we can do at home to implement some more of these empathy training
skills. Yeah. So this is all of this and more is covered in The Danish Way of Parenting, your new book. Tell our listeners where they can find the book.
It's on all online channels and in bookstores across America. You can find out more on thedanishway.com, or my author website is jessicajoellealexander.com. And I'm tweeting and Instagramming about all of these values.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So, and it's Jessica Joelle Alexander, Joelle Alexander.com.
Mm-hmm.
And the
yes.
website is danishway.com or the Danish Way?
Yes, thedanishway.com.
TheDanishWay.com. Okay, great. Thank you so much for joining us, Jessica. Really interesting conversation and an interesting comparison between countries and cultures. So when we come back, we will shine the spotlight on moms. And Cindy Simmons is a mom of two children. SurvivingMommy.com is her blog. It'll be a great discussion. Stay with us. We're shining the spotlight on moms in our continuing series to talk to everyday moms like you and me. And I'm pleased to welcome Cindy Simmons. She is the mother of two children and blogs at survivingmommy.com and tweets at survivingmommy. And that Twitter handle and the blog is based on her that you are a breast cancer survivor. Tell us about that, Cindy.
I am. Thanks for having me. I'm a 6-year breast cancer survivor. I was diagnosed at the same age that my mom was diagnosed, and she is a 4-time cancer survivor. She had breast cancer 3 times and uterine cancer 1. So I thought,
wow.
Well, I just want to be like my mom.
Not in all
really.
Things.
but
that's great. So you've been free for 6 years, did you say? Cancer-free?
Yes, for 6 years now, and it feels great, which is kind of the way I kind of got the name for the blog. I mean, you're, you know, a breast cancer survivor, but in addition to surviving cancer, it's all about just really finding joy in surviving life, whether that's being a wife, being a mother, being a friend, being a daughter, you know, whatever. It kind of encompasses all that has to do with surviving life.
That's a great, and those are great IDs you have for your social channels. So you actually just left a long career in radio.
Yes, my whole life has been spent in radio, and I was at my last radio station here in Atlanta. I did a morning show there that I hosted for 12 years, and the last 5, I was blogging for the radio station, and I love telling stories, which is a lot of what I did on the radio, but I loved writing the stories, and I loved doing that for the radio station, but it felt like it was a little limiting because everything sort of had to be approved, and I wanted more freedom to, you know, make my own hours and not have everything approved and just write really about anything that I wanted to. So I left about 1.5 years ago, and I got exactly that, freedom and happiness and a little more time with my family, which I love.
Yeah, that's perfect. So you're writing, are you freelancing or do you have your own, did you start your own business? How did you parlay that?
I just write for survivingmommy.com. I write just whatever I feel like writing on, you know, a daily basis, weekly basis, whenever the mood strikes me. I mean, of course, do encounter writer's block once in a while, but
oh, yes.
I love it. I just love sharing stories, and I took a lot of our following from the radio station. They came over to the writing world, so they follow my website, survivingmommy.com, which has been a nice compliment that they went from following my story sharing on the radio to sharing it on the website.
And that's awesome. Good for you. And I should apologize because I know when you're writing a blog, which you do, that's a job. So I shouldn't have assumed that, you know, that's not all you're doing or that is all you're doing rather. So that's wonderful.
It is mostly what I'm doing. I fill in occasionally for I have a lot of friends in radio. So sometimes I'll go and fill in on the morning show, a local country radio station here when one of the hosts is out. And that's just really because I've had a long standing friendship with the two of them. So they'll occasionally ask me to come in. So I suck it up and go back to waking up at 3:30 in the morning when they need me to.
I could say Maria asked me to host for her when she's unavailable, and I don't have to get up that early. It's basically, you know, it's a
that's like
work,
the middle
work
of the
week.
Night. It's really not the morning.
Yeah. So you have your children are relatively young, so that's good that you can spend more time with them. That's got to be so rewarding.
Oh, it's wonderful. My oldest just turned 11, and my youngest is 3, and I have one, she's the 11-year-old, she's already back in school, but my other one does not start for another week. And unfortunately, I just broke my foot the other day, so I'm not able to take either one of them to school right now, so that's disappointing and frustrating at the same time.
Yeah, no, and that's, plus the fact even just running around after a 3-year-old is enough to...
Yes. exhausting already, but add a broken foot onto it, doubly exhausting.
Right. So you talk on SurvivorMommy.com. You talk about your journey and what else is on the blog. And we have about 30 seconds left.
Okay. Really, we've been traveling so much because once I went through my illness, I just realized, you get one chance at life. And I want to travel a lot, so we've really made a big deal of traveling in our family. My mom lives with us, and she's lived with us since my youngest was born, so over 3 years now. So we try to do these really great family vacations together. We're big Disney fans. We love to go to Disney. But really, any opportunity we have to be together as a family to travel, we do and take advantage of it, and I write about those experiences as well.
That's awesome. Good for you. And you're right. We need a wake-up call sometimes to realize life is short. So it's good to enjoy every moment.
We're trying to. Thank you so much for having me today.
No problem. And good luck, Cindy. So it's survivingmommy.com. Check out Cindy's blog. And she tweets at Surviving Mommy as well. Good luck, Cindy. And when we come back, we're joined by Kelly Wallace. She is the well-known digital correspondent and editor-at-large for CNN. We'll be talking about distracted driving and incidents that are popping up. And think of Pokemon Go. We'll be right back.
You succeed at the most important career you'll ever have. Welcome to Mom Talk with Maria Bailey.
It is my great honor to welcome Kelly Wallace. She is a digital correspondent and editor at large for CNN, and she focuses on family, career, and work-life balance, and is an award-winning journalist and TV pro, I should say. Kelly is going to be talking about a really interesting topic because, as I know in my house, I've got kids walking around not paying a bit of attention to where they're going because they're looking for the Pokemon Go. They're on the Pokemon Go app looking for the Pokemon all over the city. So welcome to Mom Talk Radio, Kelly.
Mary, great to be with you.
Thanks. So when you talk about distracted things, you know, things that distract us like Pokemon Go, you're also talking that there's a bigger issue here. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, but it's great that you mentioned Pokemon Go because it's the newest sensation, a worldwide sensation, and it really has distracted driving advocates concerned. You have had cases in recent months. We had a person in Baltimore. He was playing the game, the app, and he didn't pay attention, and he drove right into a parked police car. We had another incident in California where a girl ran into a power line. Thankfully, in both cases, they were okay. But if you are playing a game like Pokemon Go, if you're Snapchatting, if you're on Instagram, if you're on Facebook, if you're texting, and you're driving, guess what? You're not really focused on driving, and that is the big concern, that people are taking their eyes completely off the road, and we're seeing the dangers every day.
Right. So there's distracted. Are there distracted driving laws across the U.S., or is it a state-by-state basis?
It is. Right now, texting, which has been the big concern over the past number of years. So 46
yes.
states and the District of Columbia have laws which make it illegal to text and drive. But guess what? I'm sure, Mary, you're driving and you see it all the time. I see it all the time, too. People still do it.
All the time.
Because I think it's that they are not necessarily thinking they're going to get caught. The penalties are not incredibly severe, unlike drinking and driving, where the penalties can be jail time. You're not always seeing someone going to jail for texting and driving. And I just think also the stigma, it's just the stigma of drinking and driving, and it took decades for this. But now there's a real stigma. If someone says, hey, I'm going to go do some shots of vodka while I'm behind the wheel, most people would say, you're a jerk, and you're
crazy,
not cool,
right?
And don't even think about it. But if someone says, hey, I'm going to be on Pokemon Go, or hey, I'm going to do a selfie, or hey, I'm going to take a video, or I'm driving, but let me get back to you on Snapchat, no one really thinks that's a problem. And I think that's the area that's going to take longer to change, is to make it uncool and that you're a jerk if you do it. We're just not there yet.
And I think with young people that are driving, teenagers, I see it in the car next to this person. I'm thinking, what are they doing? They are literally Snapchatting. It's not just Pokemon Go now. It's also social media has also created this, we have to be instantly updating and Snapchatting, and social media has got to play a role.
It really does. And I think one of the more interesting things that we discovered during our series is that there's a real impact on our brains from social media. When we hear that ping, whether it's a Facebook alert or whatnot, they literally get this sort of hit of dopamine in the brain that's not that much different from eating and pleasure from other things. And then it's almost a bigger hit to the brain than the actual what the notification says. There's some sense that we, being plugged in and hearing what people have to say, or maybe there's something interesting when I check my phone, there's a real draw there. And that's why it's pretty hard for people to just say, okay, I'm not going to pick up my phone, because when they hear the ping, it's hard not to be drawn to it.
Exactly.
And the experts that I talk to, the best say is turn your phone off. Put the alerts
right.
on silent. Put the phone in the glove compartment or in your bag in the back of the car so that you're not tempted, because it's a hard draw for all of us.
Tell us a little bit about, you did the series for CNN, correct?
Yeah, it was really and very, very well received. Part of why it was so well received is because, just as we were saying, Mary, everybody sees it. When you're driving, you see it. When you're anywhere you are going. And also, many of us admit doing it ourselves. In fact, parents are doing it too. A recent poll found that 56% of parents say they check their devices while driving. Think of the role modeling that's going on for our kids. How can you tell your kids, hey, don't check your devices while driving,
right,
if you're doing it yourself? And part of it is, I think parents are just as addicted in ways, or addicted is a tough word, because maybe not clinically addicted, but definitely they have that phone at the ready at all times, and they're using it all day, 24/7, just like their kids. So therefore, they're taking that behavior behind the wheel, which is not only the role modeling, but we profiled one woman, a mother of two, and she doesn't text and drive. She pulled off the side of the road to text, and then she got back on the road, and the person she texted her back. And she tried to ignore it, and then she said, I literally just glanced at the phone. I don't feel like I even read the whole thing, she said. And the next thing you know, she looked up, and she is jamming on her brakes to prevent herself from crashing into a tractor. And she ended up killing a 75-year-old farmer, grandfather, and father. And she now has to live with that for the rest of her life. I thought her message was so powerful, because she could be anyone's mother or sister or friend. And none of us is going to want to live with the thought of killing someone just for looking at a text. I mean, that's a very difficult burden to bear.
Yeah, sure. And what was in the text that was so important? Nothing. Any more tips for parents, especially as we get on the road with our kids and now we're back to school soon, too? So it's really important to pay attention.
I think it's a great conversation of families to have. I think, and it's not to promote our content, but I think they should, if you're a parent and you have teenage drivers, show them the story, especially the mother who killed somebody by looking at a text, I mean, when you hear those real costs and the impact on her emotionally and her family, that's a pretty powerful thing. Also, parents, don't do it yourself. Don't tell your teenage driver not to check their devices and then you be doing it yourself. Set good examples in the car. And I do think, and there's also technology out there that parents can find out about for themselves and for their teenagers.
I was just going to say that. I think there are apps and stuff like that.
There are. I mean, most of the wireless providers have their own apps. There are a couple of others that are out on the market. A company called Cell Control has an app, and then there's this hardware that you put it in the rearview mirror that basically keeps you from texting or doing any social media updating in the car. There's another technology called Groove, which is trying to get the support of wireless phone companies, because it would basically be almost instantaneous. The minute I got in the car, my wireless provider would get some notification that Kelly is driving, therefore I'm shutting off any alerts to her phone. And I do think, from the research we've done, I do think, Mary, it's going to come down to technology, because I think the attraction, the addiction, call it what you want, is too big, that ultimately making it where you can't do it, even if you want to. Maybe the way
just
to go.
Just got to cut it off, yeah. So we can look up your segment and the research on CNN.com, correct?
Exactly. CNN.com/distracted driving, which would have links to all the pieces and videos that we have done, and also on CNN Go on demand, people can find the half-hour special on distracted driving.
That's fantastic. And we'll put a link up to that on Mom Talk Radio next week. Thank you so much, Kelly. When we return, we'll be talking to Dr. Laura Janna. We'll be talking about potty training, a really important topic that's usually so frustrating. Stay with us.
The number one podcast for busy moms, Mom Talk Radio.
To round out this segment, we're going to be talking about a huge topic that's really small, as in a small potty. We're going to be talking about potty training with Dr. Laura Janna, and she is an Omaha-based pediatrician and mother of three, and is a nationally recognized parenting expert and health communicator. Welcome to the show, Dr. Janna.
Always a pleasure to join you.
So you've got an impressive resume and lots of experience, but when it comes down to it, moms just... Oh, the potty training. I went through it three times, and I was surprised I didn't go to kindergarten in diapers. Tell us a little bit about your best tips.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, part of the challenge of potty training is not getting yourself so convinced that it's going to be a struggle that it becomes one unnecessarily.
That was me.
But I had three kids in 3.5 years, and we went through a lot of diapers and scrubbing the carpet and you name it, you know, to get through that period. But what was interesting to note, and, you know, both as a pediatrician and as a parent, and actually as somebody who owned a child care center with 200 kids in it, I've seen a lot of potty training, and what strikes me is that every child's a little bit different. But that for all of them, using sort of a positive potty training approach is really important.
I remember when I just stopped worrying about it, it became more positive.
Absolutely. And, you know, another thing I find really helpful, it's a, sort of a different way of thinking of things. I tell parents, think of it as potty learning. I mean, the fact that we use training is a little deceptive. I mean, if you think of it as a learning experience, which it really is, you know, children at that age, you know, when they're potty training, are learning how to do these things and be independent. And, you know, it's pulling down your pants and knowing where the pee and the poop go and all these things. It's much easier to maintain your cool and not get upset when you say, why would you get angry at somebody who's trying to learn something, as opposed to you have a task you're supposed to complete, and if you don't, then you've failed in your training. So again, potty learning is a really important one. And the other thing I think, just from a mindset, is, you know, I wrote a children's book, it's sort of a parenting book in disguise, called It's You and Me Against the Pee. And it's meant to be sort of this sort of funny, take the pressure off, you know, look at potty training. But the other thing it's supposed to do is remind you, right from the cover of the book and the title, that we're all in this together, right? Like, you're on the same team as your child. And again, it doesn't help to get angry with your teammates, right? Finding ways to help support teammates is sort of what we can do with that attitude, much better than we can if we let you know, our frustrations get the best of us.
Do you advocate just one parent, or can anybody help?
It can be anybody involved. I mean, it can be child care provider. It can be grandparents.
It almost would have to be if a mom's working, right?
Sure. And anyone who's involved, it's a matter of attitude. You are there as part of a team to help your child succeed. And, you know, winning is great. It's getting pee or poop in the potty. But you also, you know, celebrate the attempts as well as the wins. Because, again, in a learning experience, you don't just say when you get it perfect, when you cross every T and dot every I, you've now mastered writing. We celebrate when kids sing the alphabet when they barely get, you know, half the letters correct.
Right, right. That's
same
a good
thing
point.
For sort of the team approach and being positive about it. From a very logistical standpoint, I'm a big fan of being very well prepared for parenthood in general. And in the case of potty training or potty learning, having the supplies around that you need. And this is partly letting your child be independent. So having a step stool that lets them get to the big potty or having a little, you know, potty seat that they can sit on. Having, you know, training pants available so that even when they want to wear underwear but they're not quite there yet, that you can kind of help them overcome that period of time when they might otherwise have accidents and be frustrated. Those sorts of things can make a big difference because, again, one of the biggest challenges of potty training is maintaining your cool when not all the pee and poop goes where we ultimately want it to go.
Right.
So those things can go a long way towards making it better.
One of my favorite commercials is the kid that comes out of the bathroom. He goes, "I went by myself." And she says, "Where?" And he says, "In the bathtub or something," you know, like
right.
Not even close.
And I'm already smiling as you even mentioned that because that captures very well that essence of if you look at that as an attempt, you know, and
right.
Making progress as opposed to
exactly.
A failure, it puts a smile on your face instead of just making you dread the whole process.
And, of course, signs of readiness. Is there a difference in obviously you say each child's different, so that would just make a difference in terms of when they're ready or mature enough to start the
sure,
process.
Sure, and lots of people like to pinpoint an age, and, you know, it doesn't quite
right.
work that way. I mean, we know mm-hmm. on the early end, there are kids who very reasonably can learn to use the potty before the age of 2, but there are certainly much more typical kids who are closer to the age of 3. So somewhere in that range is sort of the typical, but the signs are really what help you understand, you know, sort of what's needed to succeed, and that's just
right.
being, you know, aware of the need to go pee or poop and recognizing it when you do so that you see a child standing in the corner, they're aware of it, and it bothers them. The bothering them part is very helpful also because
yeah.
as soon as it bothers you, you want to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Also being able to pull up and down pants independently, be able to express themselves. So usually kids are starting to become more verbal so that they can express themselves when they do need to use the bathroom. Those sorts of things are the signs of readiness that it's useful to look for because it doesn't make a lot of sense to start potty training before those skills are in place.
So where do we find more information?
Like I said, I've written a book called It's You and Me Against the Pee, and it's supposed to be a fun children's book. And I'm also very happy to have partnered with Pampers in their effort to really help parents have sort of a positive potty training experience. And so you can also look to the Pampers website for additional tips from me and from Pampers as well.
Okay, so it's pampers.com. And
yes.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Jana, and it's a great topic to cover, and we need all the help we can get. And I'm assuming we can find your book on Amazon, etc. So, Dr. Laura Jana, and it's find information at pampers.com. Now, from the Mom Talk Radio Archives, is a favorite guest coming right up. Mom Talk Radio, we're going to talk to Debbie Slevin. Debbie is a writer, producer, director, and teacher, and she's had many, many successful articles printed in national magazines and has written a play even. So welcome to Mom Talk Radio, Debbie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So your book is called Unpregnant Pause, Where Are All the Babies? So tell us a little bit about what that title means.
Well, unpregnant pause is the time in a woman's life just before menopause when she realizes that her fertility is waning and she starts to wonder, did she miss the window to become a mother? And I came to it from the perspective of wanting to be a grandmother. So did my daughter miss that window for making me a grandmother?
Oh, okay. Interesting. So did she?
Well, she's kind of hovering. She's at 35. Luckily, my son and his wife, who was 37, I believe, at the birth of my grandchild. You know, they gave me a grandchild. But what's funny on the whole journey is I've been with the book group for, we're probably together 17 years. And one night I looked around and said to them, I don't understand how this is possible. There are so many daughters. We were eight women with seven daughters, all in their 30s, all capable, professional, attractive, lovely young women, and nobody was in a relationship. And
really?
A light went off, and I started to wonder, is this a trend or is this just happening by fluke to me and to my friends? And then the research began from there.
Okay. That's interesting, and you're right. I think, well, what we know, and actually Maria Bailey just wrote her latest eighth book called Millennial Moms, and it the age of childbearing is bumping up higher and higher every year because of, I think it's because of careers, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think women want to make their mark. I think it's the Sheryl Sandberg lean in phenomenon. That
right.
You spend those first 15 years leaning in. But
right.
If you are doing that, if you're leaning into your career, you're not leaning into a husband.
Correct.
You know,
true.
It's very, very hard to be 100% at both activities.
Right. So you wrote the book basically as an inspiration to be a grandmother from your children. So you actually mentioned the unforeseen cost of feminism. That's a very interesting statement. Can you expound on that?
Sure. I raised my daughter to be an empowered young woman. And I think along the way, as I was telling her, you should have any career you want, you should get the best education.
Right.
I don't think I ever stopped to say, but you know, motherhood is a really, really wonderful part of being a woman. And I think my generation in particular so embraced the excitement and the potential that feminism brought us with job opportunities and equal pay, the whole package.
Right.
That I think we a little bit turned our back on the fact that the woman is the one who carries the baby and the joys of motherhood, because we also lived in a time that divorce was very high. It wasn't always so easy to be a mother. So we wanted our daughters to have these choices. But in the long run, now that we're aging and everyone's looking forward to seeing the next generation, there's a lot less of that generation.
Right. Right. You're right. And you know, and then it comes a point, especially with women, it is pretty finite when you're looking, like you said, at, you know, your late 40s and even late 30s, even now they can, you know, still high risk if you have, you know, over 35, if you start to think about having a baby. So very interesting. This book has got to be. And when did the book come out?
The book came out in November. And
so it's
we've been
brand
nice
new. So
talking
awesome.
About it.
I'm sorry?
What's really funny is that even the men are talking about it because they're very interested in what their role is here. Because
yes.
I was not going to interview men, and I would say three quarters into the writing, I stopped and said, wait, wait, I need to hear from them.
There's another
and what
half.
I thought was so, yeah, there is. You're not doing this. Well, some people are doing it alone.
That's
but
true.
But for those who are not, when I started to ask them and say, well, what do you see your role in this whole thing, they all said, it was really pretty uniform, that they wanted their women to do whatever they wanted, to make good money, to be, you know, successful at their careers, but they still wanted to be the man at home.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So where can our listeners find your book, Unpregnant Pause?
At Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com.
And your website?
And my website is DebbieSlevin.com.
And it's S-L-E-V-I-N. Debbie is D-E-B-B-I-E.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations and best of luck with the book. I'm going to pick up a copy. It sounds great. So This wraps this episode of Mom Talk Radio. Maria will be back behind the mic next week. For this show and past shows, check out momtalkradio.com next week. And also check us out on Facebook. We list and talk about all the guests and links to all the books and websites that we mentioned in this segment. Thank you so much. Have a great week, everybody.